Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the new show, the 10K Collective podcast. This is a podcast for advanced sellers and people who are serious about scaling their business. So delighted to have the right person for that. We're going to talk about developing your own truly unique product as opposed to just private labeling something. It's the natural step after private label, not an easy one, but we need an expert guide. Unfortunately, we have that in Ryan Chaffett of XQ Manufacturing. So Ryan, warm welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. Glad to be talking to you today.
Yeah, great to have you on. And thanks for coming and giving us some time. I believe you're coming to us from China today. Is that right?
That's correct.
So tell us a little bit more about what's behind that, because I know you've got quite a deep China background. Give us a bit of flavor of what you've been doing for the last 10, 15 years of your life.
I've actually been living in China for 18 years now. This is where I've lived most of my professional life. Came here just out of college. 14 years ago, I started my business. It was an amazing learning experience for me, especially those first few years, getting our feet under us and developing our business. And just in the last 3 or 4 years, we've really been getting into, really the last 2 years, just the whole world of supplying FBA-based businesses.
So I was going to say, so FBA is quite a new thing for you. So you've got a much deeper background in doing other things outside the FBA space then.
We're a general manufacturer. We produce goods across a very wide band of products. But yeah, so the FBA focus, which currently makes up about clients who have their primary business focused with FBA, makes up roughly 40% of our clientele right now, but it's the fastest growing element of our client base right now.
Ryan, it sounds like private label sellers, or formerly private label sellers, or FBA sellers, are coming around to getting products made for them. Is that a trend that you're seeing coming from your end?
Yeah, I would say definitely. For our two largest clients that have been, they've had their own brand for a while. I think their business model kind of predates some FBA focus, but currently they're FBA focused. So for them, they're a bit more familiar with custom manufacturing. But for the wide variety of smaller clients that we deal with, custom manufacturing does seem to be more of a new concept that they're trying to figure out and wade through as we work with them.
Right. So custom manufacturing is the key word that we should be using. Is that the sort of main term that?
That's the word I've traditionally used. We'd mentioned before that just another nice term is a private manufactured products, which is just a little bit of a play off of private labeling, but with some very key distinctives.
Okay. So that leads to the obvious question of what are the key distinctives then, or the key distinctions?
So for some of the advantages that you're going to have if you're going to develop your own product personally, I mean, when people are private labeling, obviously the opportunities for hijacking, for other people coming in with the same products and just competing on who can spend the most advertising or push in the most reviews. Is a very typical model, especially for small businesses to wade through. But when we're into custom manufacturing, you're going to have a product that's truly unique. It's not going to be the same thing as somebody else with a different label on it, obviously. When you're going this far back up the supply chain, instead of dealing with distributors or middlemen, of course, you're going to typically see a higher profit margin as well. And then also, hopefully, if you're in a product niche, you're going to know your niche well. You're going to know where the opportunities for improvements are. You're going to be reading your clients' feedback on your and your competitors' posts. You're going to know how this product needs to be tweaked to get the best product possible, or even maybe meet a market need that there's a little bit of a void in right now that you see, combining products or just improving it in any given way. So those would be the big positives, but there's also some some different challenges if you're looking at custom manufactured product versus just sourcing. It doesn't matter if you're sourcing from a middleman or if you're sourcing from a distributor on Alibaba, the process of custom manufacturing is still going to be different from a sourcing type relationship. And what are those negatives? Is that going to be the next question?
I was going to say, before we dig into that, I mean, certainly we need to know what the downsides are, but I think let's just reflect a bit on why it's worth bothering in the first place, because obviously this is going to be a bigger undertaking than just sourcing. But I think you just pointed out a distinction, which is this is not so much a sourcing exercise as in finding what's out there. It's an exercise in co-creating, I suppose, in a way, isn't it? Absolutely. So it's a different relationship. But as you said, the fact that you can put a ring around things in terms of the competitive nature of Amazon now, and that the higher profit margins, because as you put it, going further back in the supply chain, it's a very interesting way of looking at things in terms of business models, I think, to talk about where you are in the supply chain. I think that's a very good sort of rule of thumb, because retail arbitrage, obviously, you're very, very close to the consumer. You're just flipping things from some Walmart or whatever. Wholesale, you have a relationship with distributors. Private labeling, you think you've got a relationship with the factory, but it's probably with an agent in China, right? And then when it comes to custom manufacturing, you really have got to go right back to the source. Otherwise, it's going to be a bit of a mess in some ways.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about then the downsides of that or the costs of that. Because obviously having higher profit and being more defensible is incredibly important. And I can't stress that enough to anyone who's relatively new to the space who's still listening to podcasts. I mean, you know, anyone who's been around the block for more than 6 months will know how critical that is. So what are the costs we have to pay for that?
Well, one of the major costs that you'd be looking at would be the time cost. So when you're looking at sourcing something, you know, you're going to a Chinese middleman or a Chinese factory, and you know, they've either got ready goods or they're ready to go. But when you're talking about something that you see in the market as a market opportunity, we need to go into prototyping, then we might need to go into mold development, and then we're going to start manufacturing product. So instead of a typical turnaround of maybe 1-2 weeks dealing with a Chinese supplier or one day with a US distributor, you're going to be looking at a process that every project's different, and I can't stress that enough, but something that's going to take anywhere from 1 to 4 months or maybe even longer if it's really a multiple prototype kind of situation where we're sending you a prototype, you're giving us feedback on it, we're tweaking some things again. And then mold development itself can take a month or so, depending on the complexity of the product. If you need a mold, again, every project's different. So there's the time cost for sure. The money cost, well, every project is very much different. But this is actually, so if you're looking at making a plastic product with plastic injection molding, you're going to spend anywhere from $1,000 to, of course, there's no top end of this, but $10,000, $20,000 is all typical numbers as well. But that actually prevents a barrier for the small FBA seller that's just a middleman doing small numbers. They're not going to be ready to jump in and do a mold development. So as you said, it makes it a bit more defensible investing in that cost. To speak of another advantage as well, as you were saying earlier, with when you're dealing, let's say, with supplier you meet off of Alibaba, maybe they're a factory, maybe they're not. Both exist in that world. But another distinctive where custom manufacturing is different is that you're the one developing the product. You are the mold owner. So if I develop a mold on my own, if I design a product on my own, I'm going to charge the clients I'm selling to for all the time and energy I put into that, as well as my mold costs. Now, if my client's coming to me with an idea and saying, this is what we want to do, and we quote them on the mold costs, and they're the ones investing in that, well, they own it all. And we have a different price structure that we create in those situations where it's a client-driven project versus something that we would develop on our own.
It's just to summarize that then, it sounds like the main thing is that we're looking at upfront costs that are higher, certainly much longer time scales. But the advantage of that isn't just a barrier to entry for everybody else, which is obviously incredibly important, given that the low barrier to entry on Amazon is kind of cool if you're the person entering and really bad if you're the incumbent, the person who's trying to defend the market share, right? But so that's a great plus. But also, it sounds like you pay up front. So you pay a lot of money up front, but then presumably the unit costs, if you're getting a mold made for $10,000, the unit costs are actually going to be much lower. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And like with plastic products, they're just the per piece price is just so surprisingly low when you've developed the mold yourself typically.
Amazing. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So I just want to let that sink in, because for a lot of us, and that would absolutely be me, I confess, I've never really developed a unique product. I mean, I've done tiny tweaks to products in it, and they mostly went fairly wrong. When I went off surprisingly wrong, when I changed what I thought were incredibly superficial features, everything seemed to melt down, which we can maybe talk about in a second. But yeah, the difference I think is quite profound that you've just flagged up, which is the money you spend, I guess, if you average it over a significant number of units or time, would end up being about the same, but it's weighted very much up the front end. Is that a fair summary?
Well, I think the tweak your summary a little bit and say, if you're looking at significant units, it's definitely going to end up being cheaper for you in the long run to develop a mold. So we're talking a lot about plastic-based products as a good example. Again, everything's different, textiles and whatnot, but you know, if you're doing a plastic product, the first question we're going to ask is, well, before we make the mold, is how many units are you predicting here? Because if you're making a small key shaped object, we could do a mold for $1,000. But if you're going to run, if in a year you're hoping to sell a million of these little key shaped objects, the mold that we're going to make for this, we're actually going to make a cavity mold that's going to have maybe 20 different keys in it all at once. And so we're making a mold that's this big for a key with a single indentation in it, a single product coming out of it. The per piece price is going to be maybe 10 cents, 15 cents. I mean, we're making up numbers here based on the thickness. But if we have a mold with 20 cavities in it, we're talking like 2-3 cents a piece. Everything, the whole equation changes. So there's a lot of different ways to go about that. So all that's to say, if you're investing in the mold on the front end, in the long run, you're really doing enough quantity, it's going to be cheaper than even buying from a factory that has an existing mold. It should be, at least.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I guess, you know, that's the entire point. If you get to the most primitive sense of where am I at in the supply chain, if you're a person buying something, for example, I'm buying a microphone to use as a podcaster, I don't want 10,000 in my house. I don't need them. I just want to buy one unit, and therefore it's going to cost me, you know, $99 in the case of this microphone or whatever. And then I guess if I'm a retailer in a local shop, I don't really want 10,000 units either, because I can't shift them, but I might want 100 a month, and therefore it's okay to sell them, to buy them for $50 and sell for 100. And so there is a certain remorseless logic about, if you're really serious about scale, that actually the per unit cost is going to end up cheaper because you own more of the supply chain, if you like. So I mean, this probably so really stupidly obvious to you, having done it for whatever, 18 years. I mean, to me, this is still a revelation. Maybe that shows how stupid I am, but I suppose I've been brainwashed in the private label model for 4 years. So I'm just hammering this home for those who suffer from the same affliction. Tell me a little bit more about this thing that you were just talking about. If you're thinking, projecting forward, doing, you know, tons of units, that you would change the mold that you create. I mean, how does one begin to figure that kind of stuff out?
Well, that's a conversation that we're going to have with the client. You know, we're going to talk through that. We're going to give them some options. So another disadvantage about the private custom manufacturing model is that you can't try out the market as easily, you know, with buying 10 units, see how fast they sell. You're making a commitment up front. So one model that a client might do is they want to try it out. Maybe they'll just spend $1,000 on that single piece mold and the single cavity mold. And that allows them to try it out. Now, if it really hits big, if it's really one of those winner products, then they might come back and they develop the 20-piece mold. If your product's bigger, I mean, if your product's bigger than a bread box, most everything's a one-cavity mold. There's a lot of different equations there. But if you're doing a key-shaped product, we're probably going to quote you on three different options. This is what it would cost you up front and per piece for a one-cavity mold, a five-cavity mold, and a 20-cavity mold. You make the call. How much do you want to invest? How much confidence do you have in this product? How do you think you might want to tweak it for a second generation 6 months from now, for a second generation product?
So that's, I like what you're saying there. I mean, yeah, you can't try the market out, but you can still sort of scale up from single cavity mold, which is obviously the upfront cost is a lot cheaper, but the per unit or the per piece price is, I tell you've been in China for a while because you say the word piece very naturally. Everyone else talks about units, but yeah, same thing. If anyone's listening, he's confused by that distinction, I think. Yeah, single cavity mold, cheaper upfront, but more per unit. So there is still a way, in other words, to scale from a, you know, a moderate commitment to a more serious commitment to a really big commitment based on market feedback, right? That sounds like that's what you're saying. Okay.
That's a good summary.
And the other thing to say is that nobody, I mean, and this is the above all the thing that I've realized is that lots of people teach different business models, retail arbitrage, private label, custom manufacturing. You know, there's probably something else like build your own factory course coming out next week. But you know, the truth is, I think there's no reason.
You got something. Let's start it.
Yeah, you would be the person to create that course. But I mean, there are a few people famously who started off private labeling and ended up just literally building their own factory. I mean, it's pretty damn rare, but it does exist. But I mean, even Will Chernlin and his brother, right, famously owned their own warehouses because they borrowed them from their folks, which is kind of unusual. And again, that does exist. So I suppose what I'm saying is, though, there is no reason to be rigidly tied to one level or other of commitment to a type of product, right? You can start off retail arbitraging something and end up doing custom manufactured products. I mean, I know several friends of mine who've got into that in exactly the same way. So, I mean, I think that's not a major downside for me, as long as you don't go straight into custom manufacturing without any knowledge of a marketplace. I guess that's not such a big problem, I would say.
Yeah, that's one of the other disadvantages if you're investing in a product and it ends up not to have the market you thought it would be. Obviously, that's the downside.
Yeah. I mean, everything's got its cost, right? Let's talk a little bit more. I mean, tell us a bit more about some of this manufacturing terminology you're coming up with. I mean, you mentioned plastic products and molds and cavities. I mean, without obviously, I'm not expecting to become a mechanical engineer out of the end of this, but could you just give us an overview of the different manufacturing techniques that would be applied to different materials and the sort of implications for somebody with a sort of small business person head on?
Well, first, let me say that one thing we try to set ourselves apart as a company is just being able to communicate with our clients. And so we work with a lot of different clients. Some of our clients are already experts in their product area. They're sending us detailed product specification charts, CAD drawings, whatever, and quality control standards. And we work with that. We also work with clients to have some hand-sketched drawings, some general concepts. They see a market opportunity, and we have conversations with them about how to develop it. But we try to set ourselves apart. Obviously, as a U.S.-run manufacturer in China, we're obviously pretty unique. And so we can come alongside and work our clients through a lot of the terminologies and the decisions that they're going to have to make and guide them the best. You know, we see that if our clients are going to have success, you know, we've got their mold in our hands, we're going to be the best solution to continue manufacturing. We want to see them move from that 100 unit mark to that million unit mark, because that's good for everyone. But so terminology, yeah. So multi-material products are where we love to be when we're not just making a single material product, but something that's a bit more, slightly more complicated in its assembly. So we do some basic electronics sometimes. Electronics investment is a bit more and developing your circuit boards and everything. So that's something we don't do a ton of, but there's the electronics and circuit development boards for developing your circuit boards for that. Then we've got wood-based products, which are fairly easy. Wood crafting, luckily, is not the most complicated rocket science in the world. We deal with a lot of plastic and rubber. So those are generally plastic injection molded. Occasionally you can get into extruded products, which just basically means that the shape is continuous. It's a two-dimensional shape stretched out long, you know, flat board or a tube or a U-shaped channel or whatever it be. So we often use those in other products. The setup costs for extruded products are less than for plastic injection molding, the injection process. Then we can also get into machining different materials. Machining typically comes with metalwork, but you can also machine plastic products as well. Yeah, machined metal is obviously a huge part of a lot of products. You can also cast things as well, but machining is a very common process for a lot of the products you might see on FBA and forging and bending and all sorts of things. And then textiles. we have our own in-house general assembly and our own textile factory here as part of our facilities, and a small woodworking workshop as well. So textiles. We love textiles because it's something we're very competent in. Bags and tents and all sorts of things involve a textile element to them. Those are the broad areas that we work across. Pouring foam is a big thing. We make a lot of archery targets that are poured foam into animal shapes and things like that. So the foam expands and it's got a lot of elasticity to it. It's a special type of foam that allows it to heal well when you pull the arrows out. But the pouring foam works in a lot of different products. So those products typically take up a lot of volume, but are one of the lowest cost items you can get per cubic meter.
Okay, so let's take a second to absorb some of this stuff and just reflect back. I mean, obviously, again, to people with a sort of engineering background, some of this stuff will seem unbelievably basic, but I mean, a lot of us do not have that. So basic electronics sometimes, and I guess, as you said, that's investing in the circuit board. Nice to know that wood-based products are fairly easy, because I got a feeling from the marketing perspective that because there's such a huge sort of general drive towards sustainable and environmentally friendly products and stuff, I mean, there's probably a perception of those as being somehow more sustainable. I'm sure that's probably the opposite to the truth, but so that's quite...
Yes, no, I think the answer to that.
Right. I guess it depends where the wood comes from, right? And that's a conversation.
Well, bamboo is a very very common wood-based product that's billed as very environmentally friendly, and it generally is. So yeah, bamboo's a popular thing, and obviously China's the number one place where bamboo products are coming out of. So we do... both bamboo textile products, because there's a textile yarn you can make out of bamboo, and then there's also wooden bamboo products, which, you know, coasters, fans. We've done a variety of things out of that. When you export wooden products out of China, there's some basic minimums. They're not very high, but some basic minimums, because China needs to do wood inspections to make sure the wood was lawfully harvested. And so there's a couple $100 worth of just inspection fees before something goes out when you're dealing with wood.
Okay, but that sounds pretty straightforward. I mean, so wood is actually an interesting material to consider from that point of view. Because I'm always looking at things from the sort of holistic perspective from the top of the business down, which is if you can find a product that is, well, I suppose it's the blue ocean strategy idea without being pretentious about it. I mean, in other words, so if it's low cost to us because it's straightforward, and easy to inspect, and the certification level is fairly basic, but it's also higher perceived value by the consumer. That's a sweet spot to be in, right? So I'm always trying to look for those sweet spots. So wood sounds quite interesting to me, and especially bamboo. As you say, for textiles, it's all the rage, bamboo socks, you name it. That's interesting. And then which of these things we talked about, plastic, rubber, and metal, is there, and this is the primitive dumb question, but forgive me, is there a particular type of material that is generally more expensive and or more complex to work with, to put it in simple terms?
Well, as mentioned before, I mean, plastics are really cheap to mass produce once you get that initial investment in with your molds. You know, metal machining, sometimes it's also just the process. Machining a metal, you know, each piece that you go through is going to take the same amount of time on a machine. So those processes can be a little bit more per piece. If you're making a box, to make that box out of foam or plastic is going to be super cheap. Wood's going to be a little more expensive. Metal is probably going to be a little bit more expensive, especially if you're machining it. Sometimes you get those little tin boxes that are folded, which can be more of a different type of automation that you can do those on.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So basically, the advantage of plastic is the most mass-producible kind of material in the sense that the mold is the thing, but the material itself, I guess the word plastic, we forget that it is it was originally used, and the Germans use it, for example, in plastic arts, meaning stuff made in 3D. And it's a very broadly based term, and I suppose what it means is it's a material that can be plastically moved. In other words, it's very flexible, it's very moldable. I guess that's kind of the essence of the stuff, right? I guess that's why that was invented, because we'll forget that before whatever it was, celluloid was invented, everything was made of metal, wood, and whatever else, I suppose. So yeah, there's something intrinsic about the material that is therefore basically around the cost is up front, it's about the mold, and then everything else is cheap, right? That's the basic nature of plastic, if I'm understanding. Wow.
Well, you pointed out a good thing there, that there are a lot of different types of plastics to deal with. You know, when you're looking at making a suitcase, a rollerboard that you take on an airplane, you want to be very careful about what plastic you choose for that if you're doing it out of plastic. ABS is a very common material because it's very hard. You can hit it with a hammer and nothing's going to happen to it. But if you did that same suitcase out of PE, I don't even know if you could do a mold that large without it. It would bend and warp. But, you know, you take a hammer to that and everything's just going to come apart right away.
So tell us about the types of plastic then. So ABS, PE, can you just break this down for us a little bit and give us some examples of real world products that would be made there?
Because I'm not the best engineer in the company, but just a few general types. So ABS is a very hard plastic. So you actually need to make a more robust mold if you're going to do an ABS, because the pressure needed to fill up that mold is going to be a lot more. So we have to use a harder steel for that, which takes more machining time. So you can double your mold cost if you're dealing with a hard, if you need to fill it with a hard plastic like ABS. PE is one of your cheaper types. It can be stiff and rather brittle. PU is going to be a little bit more flexible. And there's low density poly PU and there's high density PU, but that's got a little bit more flex to it. We make a product that can be hit by a golf club, a sporting good product, and it has to have a lot of bounce to it. We need to choose the right type of plastic to make that happen. And it's a very special type.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously just massive amounts of, how can I put it? Well, general expertise and experience that comes. I mean, okay, yeah, you may not be an engineer, but you've lived in this world a long time. So you're talking a lot of sense. And if you were an engineer, you'd probably just start talking in a way that would cease to make sense to me or anyone listening very quickly, I suspect.
Hopefully I'm a good middle ground there. We have our engineers on staff, and one of my main jobs is to be a communicator.
Yeah.
Because most of my job is related to sales and connecting.
Yeah. But I think good sales is and communication. I remember speaking to a coach of mine years ago, who was, to be fair, a sales coach and a remarkably salesy oriented person. But he said, coaching and selling, same thing. And I think to some extent, selling and communicating, it often comes to the same thing. I mean, if you're not getting a sale, it's often because you're not very, very clearly communicating why somebody should buy your thing and why it's different from anybody else. So just to, as an aside there, I think, yeah, you are doing a lovely job of communicating this stuff, I think. So let's bring a little bit more onto what you guys do. I mean, it's not a big sort of pitch necessarily for you guys, but it's something for people to explore working with somebody who can guide them through the process. What are the main sort of pain points that you've seen with people, say, coming from a private label background? So they have some experience of products, they certainly understand the markets on Amazon and possibly eBay or through e-commerce stores. They have some understanding of the basics of manufacturing, but they want to develop a custom product. What do you think their main, say, three pain points are that they generally would experience?
We talked a little bit about timing and how that's different. You know, I've had clients that I've started working with, and, you know, we get some of their product going, we put it on one of our containers to the US, and then clients like, hey, I need this product by Christmas, this other product that I want to introduce, and it's really important. You have to find a way to get it done. And I'm thinking your boat just left yesterday, and we haven't even started talking about a mold yet. So, or we haven't even talked about the prototype or whatever. So that was a hard thing for that client to accept. He's like, no, you don't understand how important this is. You don't understand how good this opportunity is going to be. And I unfortunately didn't have an answer that was going to solve that problem for that client.
Yeah, I think there's a classic thing that they say in dealing with the Chinese, that if you seem to be in a hurry, then this is going to be bad for you. Apart from anything else, they're super sharp business people, and they will normally pick up on the fact that you're in a hurry and raise the price. But then also, yeah, this stuff takes time. And I know from speaking with friends of mine who develop unique products, that the timescales cannot be really seriously compressed. I mean, we, you know, every so often I get together in groups of some pretty advanced people and we thrash this out. And, you know, normally the conclusion is, yeah, there's no magic way to speed this up. But what you want to do is make sure that the costs are reduced and the quality is improved, really. So tell us a little bit more about this thing. There's one thing that came up a while ago in such a discussion was the question of, when you're, you know, say you're running a $3 or $4 million a year business, something along those lines, you're probably going to be your own product development manager to some degree, but you're going to have to work with other people who are between you and the factory, or even within the factory, between you and the actual guys who just say, right, let's order 1,000 or 10,000 of these units to develop the products. how important is it to get somebody who's got very specific product knowledge in, say, working with ABS plastic as opposed to PQ plastic or PE plastic, if I've even got those abbreviations right?
Well, we love our clients who know what they want. We love it when a client that comes to us and says, you know, these are the exact specifications. This is the tolerance that it can be, that it, the tolerance of error that we can have in certain measurements. Those are great. Those are really easy to quote on quickly. You know, it's much easier than the client that comes to us and says, women's products, I see an opportunity in that. Can you make me something cool? Or obviously there's some other clients love a bit more, obviously a bit more understanding what they'd like to create than that. But it's on a spectrum. And if a client has a general direction, we'll work with them, but they don't have to be experts on their product area. And that's kind of a service that we try to offer, that we can maybe hopefully we can save you the cost of employing one or two employees in your home country just by working with us, that we have our experts here and our experts are going to cost less than your experts.
That's a good
so
point.
There's yeah.
I think also what struck me very strongly with the conversation with a couple of guys who are definitely creating very much custom products. And by the way, they're doing way better with them in terms of profitability and sustainable profit than with private label products. So just to reinforce the point you're making, I can say from experience with not my personal experience, but those my friends of mine who are doing that, definitely worth it. Absolutely, 100%. So, which is why I've got you on the show, because I know how important this is. And I think it's only going to be more important. But he was saying about how when you're creating a product, and I can't remember what materials are, so I'm not going to break any confidence because I can't remember, but he had a product that was made of two different types of materials. Maybe one was foam and then there was some form of plastic. And now I know from this conversation with you just how many types of plastic there are. I had a vague sense of that.
Well,
and he was saying
there's many more.
Many more, I'm sure. There are.
There's patented types of plastic out there that DuPont and the major international companies are selling. If you need very specific things, it'll handle super high temperatures and whatnot.
No, I'm sure, but without blowing people's brains with more specifics. But the point being that he was trying to create a product that was made of some foam and some plastic, say. I think that's what it was. And he said, actually, he realized that between him as the basically the product development manager for his company. And he needs to be in a way because he knows what his customer wants. He knows where the company needs to go and what they stand for and therefore what their products are and the price point versus quality and the positioning in the market and all that stuff. But between him and the manufacturer, he was realizing that he was needing to employ experts in very, very specific types of manufacturing. And so it sounds like you would be able to substitute for that. So instead of having to employ somebody who knows all about how foam behaves in different situations and how that would work within your products, you guys would be able to provide some kind of service like that. Is that about right?
We can definitely be a part of that process. And it is reasonable to say that, yes, you might be able to save a hire or two or a consultant or two in your native country by working with a company like ours. But I also don't want to totally undermine the value of in-house, knowing the direction that you want to go, knowing what you want to get done. But hopefully with our services, it wouldn't be an essential thing that you'd have to do.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for Kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.